Hi, my name is Lowell, pronouns he, him, and this is a little talk we're trying to do. We've done one of these so far for Open Hearth. One of the things that was suggested when we did our beginning of the year, the general discussion was putting together more like talks. Though I suspect people want more podcasts on topics is actually what they might want. But we did one in January, and this time we're talking about a topic that we've covered before in a previous discussion. Shane is present, who was here when we Shane and Ray and I did talk about this before, and I think it's something worth looking at again because it is really the crux of a lot of what PPTA does, a lot of what Forge in the Dark does, a lot of what the games that are player facing in terms of roles and mechanics really kind of lean into. There's some other games that are using it, thinking particularly of Fate and how it does the success with cost as a mechanical element. But it's really such a cornerstone of the PBTA experience. And so one of the things I want to talk about is the fact that when I started running PBTA, I did not understand it. I did not understand it at all. I did not get how it worked. I thought I did. And I ran a PBTA hack that I had written, and I ran it for 10 sessions, and Rich was kind enough not to strangle me throughout because I didn't understand exactly when a hard move came up, when a soft move came up, when a GM reaction came up, like what I needed to be giving the players, what I needed to be handing them. And my vision of cost really tended to be incredibly mechanical. Harm, situational setbacks, very tight mechanical in the moment options there. And that's partly because I didn't understand the scope of player moves. I didn't understand then the scope of GM moves. And it wasn't until after that, after I'd also run a disastrous session of Legacy first edition, Life Among the Ruins, which was not the first game I should have run on the Gauntlet, and yet I did. And it was super complicated. But there was an essay that was floating around back in the days of G Plus with someone talking about how they had issues running Dungeon World, and somebody going through and saying, after they had described their style, they're like, that's not how Dungeon World works. When you roll and the GM doesn't move, that's when they do it. Those moves come as a result of a player move, or if everybody at the table is kind of sitting there and waiting. And then otherwise, the GM is not, intruding, forcing things on you, that the game is about those roles and reactions and the GM shepherding along. And it wasn't until that I finally understood kind of what was going on, and it took me a while. So that was a really important turning point for me. I will say that for me, if I have any strength nowadays as a GM in giving hard moves and soft moves, it's because of my unwanted thought syndrome. I am one of those people who, when I see something that is dangerous, immediately I'm envisioning how I'm going to hurt myself with it. I see a garbage disposal and I immediately envision that. I picture dropping the knife. I'm walking downstairs with scissors and I've already envisioned myself slipping and falling. This is a constant paranoid thing that I thought everybody did, but apparently there's some people for whom that is a less vital part of their mental imaginary landscape. But it is a thing that when I'm listening to people in play, when I'm listening to characters and things, that is in the back of my mind is, ooh, what's, ooh, I hope this doesn't go wrong, because here's what would happen if it did go wrong. And the trick has been for me, at least, to lasso that to the genre expectations to figure that out. I think one of the things with PBTA that gets focused on are the basic moves and the playbook moves. Like those are the engines people can talk about, can show that. And those are the sexy parts that the players see. But there are the descriptions of the GM moves that are in the different books that I think are really one of the places where the game designer can show us what they envision happening, what they envision going on. There's the principles, and I know Rich had a whole episode on Plus One Forward just talking about the GM principles for PBTA, but I do think the hard move listings are really important. Like one of my favorite games is Blackout, that is about civil defense in Blitz era, and it has very standard hard moves, but it's got a couple that are really interesting. One is to use their gender against them. Because you're playing women in this situation as civil defense workers, it's a little bit like how we see in Night Witches, the explicit idea that is a topic, that is a genre element that we are going to be leaning into. And mind you, safety tools may offset that, but it's the way that's phrased is really important to me. There's another one in here, show the situation deteriorate around them. That's phrased very differently than it is in, say, Apocalypse World. It is a place where they're dealing with the bombing around the city, that one of the hard moves is to show how things are continuing to break down. As another example of sort of genre-based hard moves, I'm going to point to, with apologies here, to Hearts of Wulin. And for me, this was a really important part. What the Hearts of Wulin idea for hard moves are is a list of genre tropes. It is about, one of the hard moves is having someone confess to them. Another one is having an ally accidentally betray them, having someone fall in love with them. These are all great hard moves that are the melodramatic, the soap opera things that we can bring into play. And the last thing I want to say before I kind of start asking some questions is the lesson that I had to learn, that actually Rich kind of taught me over time as I played with him, is the fact that hard moves, those kinds of reactions there, happen in the moment, like a person makes a roll and there's a hard move, but it doesn't necessarily happen in that moment. We can cut away to something bad happening elsewhere. The hard move doesn't necessarily fall out of the exact move that you're making. It doesn't have to tie in. If they're making an overcome roll, it doesn't have to be about the chasm that they're jumping. It's something else that can happen in that. And like, I'm going to admit, I didn't get that for a very long time. I thought that a hard move, obviously there was a thing that happened, and here's the reaction, a cause and effect that occurs within that. And I think that that's really important, especially where you can use those hard moves to reinforce the genre. We were talking about Root before we started recording, and Root is a game about factions. And a great heart move in there is to cut away to factions plotting, showing how bad things are getting ready to come down. That's our put future badness on screen, but we do it within the context of what the game kind of expects of us. Rich, like in the course of Plus One Forward, you covered like 100+ games, if not more. And in going through there, what would you say are the lessons that you took away about how hard move works, how they work in those particular games, those kinds of things?
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head by saying genre emulation baked into the hard moves is the ticket because it doesn't feel out of place. If you have a hard move that ties back to the vibe of the game that you're playing, everyone accepts it much more readily. So the best hard moves or moves that I've seen for a GM really do reflect the crisis moments and the worst possible reactions in a Supers game for masks, in a teenage supernatural drama in Monster Hearts, like, and in a dungeon for Dungeon World. These games really know their genre, and the best PBTA games, the MC moves just fold right back into. And the best part about that is they're very, very flexible because if you have this move that is out of tune with the rest of the symphony that is that genre, it's always going to be discordant every time you bring it in. You know, if you've got an action-oriented game, but there's a hard move about someone calling a dead on you, it can be very challenging to bring that in. And as a MC, one of the things I like to do is look at the hard moves list as a menu. And I'm that foodie that comes in and it's like, you know, I haven't tried explode an untenable situation lately. I need to do that right now. How do I make that work? And because the hard moves are written well enough to be folded back into the fiction, it doesn't seem out of place.
I think that's a good way to look at it. Anyone else have some think want to say thoughts, particular hard moves that you've dug, or questions you have about that? I throw that open here.
I think what Rich was just saying about like seeing the list of MC moves or reactions as a menu is really useful for me. Like it's easy when I'm running a game, especially games that I'm more familiar with, to just rely on the same handful of moves over and over again. And that can be fine, but it's useful to like between sessions or in a break, actually look at the list of moves again, and go, oh, that's something that I could be doing. Like, you know, I think trying to use the diverse list that's in front of you is really helpful.
Ian?
Well, I have a few questions, so if
Sh
anybody had
sure.
some statements to make, I would defer until they were.
We are chatting, so hit us with the questions.
Yeah, I think I have two questions. I think the first one that I have, let me make sure I have these both written down so I can have a pin stuck in this for later.
Sure.
First question that I have is, I'll put this in kind of, a concrete example. Presently, I'm running a game of Scum and Villainy, for a group of players who I think mostly have trad gaming experience. Obviously, there's some differences between a game like Scum and Villainy and the more kind of, I guess you could call it orthodox PBTA stuff that we've been discussing so far, but I think that there's some similar. The GM, at the very least, is in a similarly reactive sort of role, right? The the premise, I think, is that the players are doing stuff and the GM is like receiving those actions and responding in some way. And I think sometimes I run into an assumption by the players based on this kind of past of trad gaming that when I use a, a complication on a 1-3 or even a mixed success to foreshadow something happening, or as you said, to kind of cut away to one of their rival factions plotting or scheming or something, the assumption that they seem to have is, well, you were always planning on that anyway. That's, that's what you were angling for from the beginning. And I guess this is a much larger question about like how to kind of induce that kind of shift in stance from, I am here and I'm waiting for the GM to kind of like give me impetus to act versus I'm here. I'm an actor with agency in this situation. I'm going to do what I want and damn the torpedoes, so to speak. So maybe that's like a larger question than we really have to get into here, but I think for me, it's like, do you have any maybe guidance or best practices as far as like selling that this is a result of that role that just happened, and not something that was always waiting in the wings, so to speak.
That's a really interesting question. And I think it goes back, like there's a whole Forge theory about illusionism and all of those weird presentation things. Is your desire for them not to feel that way? Is it so that they understand what you're doing? Or is it that you find that because they perceive that you already had this plan that they feel like they're boxed in? Like what do you think is the Rich, I see you
I was
leaning
just going to say,
forward.
maybe Ian, maybe it's okay if they think you're a genius.
I was going to say something similar, actually. A lot of GMs strive to make it look like they've planned everything. It kind of makes you shine, I think. But I can also see it from the other perspective where they may feel like it was always going to happen. This was you were driving us towards this, and they feel railroaded. So, but I mean, from my point of view, I just come out and tell my players, I just say, look, this is how it works. I haven't done any particular prep for this, and what comes up in the course of the session is due to your actions, due to your roles, and whatever moves come out of it are maybe appropriate to you at the time, I guess.
Well, to sort of further this idea of a hard move as a kind of storytelling tool or and a way to emphasize certain genre tropes, there are some games in this family. I'm thinking specifically of Burning Hearts Forever, which have a degree of like I would they certainly have a kind of like emotional atmosphere that that is consistent across the many genres that are possible within that game. But I think the genre tropes from F1 racers to JoJo protagonists, like there's maybe some crossover there. So my follow-up question is, for a game like that either can offer different genre settings or that has a maybe a particularly iconoclastic setting that doesn't have a lot of like immediately recognizable cultural references. What would your approach to something like that be?
In terms of designing or in terms of running, what do you mean there?
Well, let's say, for example, we had a game that was based on, hard boiled or like Hong Kong action movies, the reach for a hard move within that genre milieu, I think for fans of that genre is going to be immediately legible to the point where there might be a list of moves in the game. But for a game that has like a couple of different expressions of genre, like the game that, you know, like Burning Hearts Forever, there might not be something that's just immediately obvious as far
as you know, you mentioned JoJo there, and I know of JoJo. I've seen pictures, but I couldn't tell you what the genre elements are of JoJo. And so, like, if I found a game that was based on that, like, I would go to the GM moves because I would assume that the GM moves would be telling me what the tropes are, what the things are, and that would help me get a grip on it. And I would think with Burning Hearts Forever, you know, I would hope that if they have like subgenre things, there'd be some discussion of like what the moves are differently in the different, different games. In some ways, like again, back to JoJo, if you were playing JoJo, I would watch what the GM did as hard moves that I was playing to learn what the genre tropes were and to pick up on what the fictional permissions were. I don't know if that makes sense there.
Sure. I also want to say I don't have a copy of Burning Hearts Forever open in front of me.
All right. No.
These things. I love that game. I didn't want that to come off as a knock.
No. I will say one thing to kind of go back to your first question, then I want to throw it more open to people. One of the things I think that is a real opportunity when you do a hard move to show people how open and flexible the world is to come at your hard move as a collaboration and like say, who is it that you love in this moment? Who is it that your character really cares about? Or who is it that your character would hate to see right now? Like take an opportunity, as, especially if you're in a scene that has room to breathe, to maybe ask the player to choose their own poison in some ways. And to illustrate that, like, I'm about to do a hard move. I've kind of got this set up. I know the lane that we're in, but I'm going to let you tell me who's coming down the road here. And I'm going to roll with whatever you give me. You know, that's what's going to happen. You then get to see which players are defensive about their characters and which ones aren't, I think, at that point. Rich, I saw that you were going to say something earlier on this.
Yeah, I couldn't help myself. I ran Burning Hearts Forever, set in Star Wars. So it kind of breaks the seal on that because what genre? Friggin' Star Wars. But I did pull up the PDF to glance. And I will say the narrator, which is the name of the GM, the narrator moves, there are not like, I'll have to look in the book because there are moves like Break Their Hearts, Wind Up a Punch. I'm sure there's further description of that, but those seem like emotional beats and also a setup for a fight. There are, interestingly enough, villain moves, which are hard moves wrapped, similar to masks, wrapped in the shell of a particular personality. And I think that can help to define a Burning Hearts Forever game as if you have particular villains. In fact, that's what, when my son Donovan first described JoJo's to me, he talked about the characters because nothing else made sense to me that he said aloud about JoJo's. I don't understand it, but that's perfectly valid. A lot of people love it. To circle back, and I think you did start to answer. You gave an answer, Lowell, to the first question that Ian had posed. And I, sorry for my flippant answer, but my real answer is, if they think that you planned it all along, you can throw it a little bit back on them, like Lowell, with the open question of, okay, this is a person that you define, and now we roll with it. There's no way I could have planned that other than to think, yeah, it would be cool if I brought in so-and-so's significant other of some kind, that will give you some ways to show them, hey, this is not scripted at all. But it's hard if there are people who just that's the way their muscles are trained to think that you've got it all planned out. It's going to take some time. I have a person who I've played Masks with for 2 years, but she still has a very D&D-ish mindset, and she just brought in a new character, the Innocent. The Innocent is, I'm sorry, this is not that long. It feels like it's long, but the Innocent is a playbook that you were a hero as a youth from the past, and now you've been thrust into the now, which is your future, and the future you is a villain. And there are things to discover about what caused that turn and decisions for you to make. Okay, do I accept that as my path to villainy, or do I reject it? And what do I do then? And that's very, very interesting. And she said to me, I can't wait until to find out what happens and why my character became a villain. But I could tell her turn was for you to tell me, Rich. And I said, girl, I don't know. We're going to find out together. And you can reinforce it. You can say it, as Ronas said, you can declare that. But if they don't, like, if they're from certain circles of D&D, they don't trust that. You know, rocks fall, you die. And they're just going to have to learn it over time. You just reinforce it where you can, and eventually they'll come to understand, or they won't, and they'll think you're a genius. So really, either way, it's okay.
I think it's worth reinforcing that every player that you play with is a product of every single game they've played. You are not seeing them in the moment. You're seeing the history of every bad GM, good GM, bad player base, good player base. You're seeing them at the table. And, you know, if a player isn't trusting you, it's because they've gotten burnt before that, or that's how they run, you know, if they're, you know, if they're also a GM. And I think that's really interesting. As a parallel to that, and I'm going to throw back to Hearts of Wulin. I have in Hearts of Wulin the study move, and a study move is our information gathering move, and it is the place where more players get stuck when we're playing than any other place. Not combat, not the inner conflict. It's that, A, you can ask anything you want. And for some people, that freedom is hard. They would like a list of questions, as they've seen in other PBTA games, or like some things. And I appreciate that. And usually when people get stuck there, I say, well, think of other PBTA games and the kinds of things you will ask. And they'll often go to that. But the other thing is that with the study move, you can spend the hold that you have to not ask a question, but to make a declaration and to say what you think has happened. And one would think that this would be an incredibly powerful tool. And I've seen some people who've worried about it being too powerful, but people don't take that option very often. Because they're nervous about that fictional responsibility and that fictional positioning on it. And it consistently surprises me. Sometimes they'll ask me a question and I'll say, now, do you actually want to answer that question? Do you know the answer that you want? And sometimes they will say, yes, I kind of would like it to be this. And then we move to that. But a lot of times they'll just ask me. And then I try to think of the thing that they don't want the answer to be, and I will answer it that way, because I'm perverse in that way. But yeah, it's hard for people sometimes to get on board about like what that improv means, what responsibility they have, what the GM is doing. It's a challenge.
So the thing that I'm taking away from this, and to tie it back into the hard moves, is that I think something that is really difficult maybe the thing that is really difficult to the thing that is hard to get acclimated to, coming from a trad background like the one that I just, you know, the ones that I described, is that degree of like meta knowledge or not, you know, knowledge of like what a protagonist in this particular genre like would do for good or for ill in the, you know, in this moment. And it seems like the thing that I'm taking away from this is to make these hard moves hit is just to lean even further into that, into the idea of the meta knowledge, where you were saying before, what would be the worst outcome here?
Yeah, I think that, and not just the genre novels there, I think that the other part of that is to know their characters. Remember what their characters' connections and entanglements and even moves are. Just a little bit, so that when you do the hard move, you can reincorporate facts that they've put out there, characters that they've established, things and beats that they've already put out there. I will, you know, I one of the things I do, and I do very, very little prep, but one of the things I do is at this before a session with the PBTA game is I look over everybody's playbook moves. And I say to myself, which of these haven't they gotten to the table? Which of these haven't they had the opportunity to play out? And I try to mentally make a note for myself. Is there a way, if they give me a hard move, if we get, I get that in my hands, a tasty, delicious falls on my plate. Is there a way that I can do that in a way that points back to the hard moves, gives them opportunity to use their hard moves? There are some hard moves in Hearts of Woodland that are more contingent than others, and those are the kinds of moves that you want to look for, ones that require a particular kind of trigger, and you want to look at how to give that. Like, for example, one of the moves is that you can call in a set of agents. There's one of the playbooks that has that, or you know, to help you out, and that's a good opportunity if the person has it and they haven't been able to do that, to put them in a place where they need to have somebody come and rescue them, or pop out from the crowd and cause a distraction, things like that. So that's another sort of level. We're looking at the genre and we're looking at the characters as they're built themselves.
Shane and I had a pretty good example of something like that happening in our Quarter Blades game the other night. And I do just, you know, just to praise Shane a little bit, it is very helpful for me when you've got players who are like, yes, please give me the hard move. I'm, you know, predicating my character on the hard move.
Yeah, no. Some people are waiting for it. They want that. They want the heartbreak. And you'll learn like the tone of the kind of thing that they want. They want to be crying over the body of their dead lover, or they want, you know, to be betrayed, or those kinds of things. You'll kind of learn what that is. It is interesting. My sister is a few years older than me, and she's the one who taught me D&D back in the day. And she still plays very, very trad games most of the time. And I've run now for her some PBTA, some Hearts of Wulin and Apocalypse Keys. And it's very clear that she still has a little bit of the trad in the back of her mind, because when you give her hard moves, she's always immediately like, okay, what's going on here? What's happening? That suspicion that she has there, that's kind of restraint, and it's actually amusing now, because I know that I can throw particular things at her, and she's gonna you know, put her hands up and not want to put her hand in the trap, as it were.
I as just a brief aside, I learned in edition 3.5, And I call that feeling when that sensibility like rears its head for me, I call that it's when Chris Perkins is in the Walls. Pop out like a funny voice and a weird outfit to tell me that I'm playing the game wrong or something. That might be slander, I don't know, but
I think that's fair. Shane, you were going to say?
I just want to note that that Court of Blades game that you mentioned was really fun, but when I was desperately begging for the hardest move possible, I of course rolled a crit. So I successfully dueled the God of the Sea, which was a very unexpected outcome.
So there are some other dimensions to the heart and move thing that I think are worth thinking about that are sort of practices that I know that we have in the back of our heads that one of the things definitely for me is a lot of these books talk about what the difference is between a hard move and a soft move, like why you do them, when you do them. And Urban Shadows, I remember particularly going over this pretty well. But I will say, and I'm curious about other people's rubrics. For me, the difference between a hard and a soft move is a hard move is when the player has walked in eyes wide open to a situation. When they have gone in with full knowledge, when they walked in, when they've had full control, they have a sense of what the costs and consequences were. When they've gone and done that, it is more likely that I'm going to go for the hard move than the soft move. If things have gone badly, have kind of stumbled and cascaded in, probably going to get a softer move. I will also say the later in the session we go, or the later in the campaign we go, the harder the moves get. If we're in the final scene of a session, those hard moves are going to be diamonds when we get to that. Just to give that payoff. Rich, like what's your logic on that distinction between hard and soft?
Well, first, I'll just tie. I was looking through, like you, other games. Bitemarks actually has defined soft moves and hard moves, which I think is really interesting and unique. I haven't seen it anywhere else. I've seen talk of soft and hard, but never defined in the codex for the MC. Here are soft moves. Soft moves are offer an opportunity without a cost, foreshadow a threat, highlight a threat or an untenable situation. Those inform you of the bad thing. So later, when you're hit by the bad thing, you don't come crying to me. Also, the best part of doing the hard move first, if that's where you choose to go, is they rolled the dice. It's not your fault. You're the one who rolled the five. I mean, I have to. It's my job. Do you want dereliction of duty? I have to do the hard move. It can be as hard as I want. I'm meandering, but I want to circle back to a thing you said earlier on about the perpendicular style hard move, meaning I'm trying to jump across a chasm. I fail to do it. As the MC, I do a hard move of, yeah, you make it to the other side where there is a monster, or you make it to the other side and your buddy, the henchman who's right behind you, falls and does the Wilhelm scream. those perpendicular moves, it's a little brain breaking because of the terminology, which the terminology of rolling a six minus for especially the early PBTA games is called a miss. And you think, we've all got the baggage. We are the products of all the games we've played before. We think when you roll bad and it's a miss, then a bad thing has happened as a result of me trying to do the thing. So that's a fault of our play and also a fault of the text. But once I started using perpendicular hard moves, it was very freeing because it allows you to think beyond the moment to moment. And there are some masters of those perpendicular, like Sarah Doombringer is amazing at the hard move that is just, well, to tie back to Ian, she had to have been thinking about that. It was just too creative. No one could come up with that on the spot. But Sarah can consistently. So perpendicular moves are great, great, great. But differentiation between soft move, hard move, I feel like every move can be soft or hard. They all need a reaction. They all need to live in the moment, whether it's a reaction to what you are trying to achieve, a setup of a new threat, a tilt to the scene. The soft move is giving somebody a chance to look for help, get nervous about it. A hard move is just a thing that you roll with. So it's how hard do you want to make this threat? You do have, like, I didn't think about this coming into today's session, but you do have in the moment that decision. You've got the menu. You've got how hard do I want to come back at them? How much time do we have? How many times have they failed before? Like, I have done hard moves because I've seen, two sixes in a row. Okay, the dice are telling us that this must be terrible. And if I don't go hard, then everyone feels like the pressure's off. And maybe I want to do that because we're early in the session, just like you talked about, Lowell. But often if the dice are telling me, yeah, these guys, this is a foobar. This is so bad. It has to be bad. That's where I go. I'll go straight hard. I mean, and again, like if you've had two sixes, you've probably gotten a soft move before the hard move comes. But if yeah, it's like that person failed, they're trying to help, they fail, or this person fails and they try to help them and they fail, then that's a whammy. That's got to be hard. So yeah, it's a little bit of dice magic. And maybe that's a more conventional style of GMing, but man, people really like care about I've rolled badly several times in a row. A bad thing must happen. But the other piece is I only let, like, if a bad thing happens, when I do a hard move, it is important to make sure that it does not result in a death spiral where it becomes hard move after hard move after hard move. Like I go two hard moves in a row and then I'm going to cut that scene. I'm going to cut away. There's no way we're going to dwell on that failure. 'Cause I know there are some people who are like, please hurt me. Please hurt me. That's their style of play. That's not how I MC. So I can only like punch twice and then I've got to cut away or completely like fade to black and you wake up in a dire situation, but it's not continuing to fail at this thing that you're trying to achieve. Does that help to describe my variation on soft and hard?
Absolutely. Other folks' thoughts on that?
I have another question, but I have it written down, and
Okay.
I'm curious about what Ron and Clint have to say, or Shane. I've talked quite a lot in this call already.
That's okay.
I was just going to say that I really like the principle of failing forward, and that it is a bit of a struggle, particularly for those of us who grew up playing more trad games, and that where failure is just that, it's just failure. You feel bad because you rolled bad and your character's going to suffer for it. They're going to lose some hit points or they're going to die or something, So the idea of failing forward and using these hard moves and the consequences from them to push the story forward is something I think that really needs to be embraced. And it can be difficult, I think, for people to do that. So I still struggle with it, to be honest, in many situations. But it always brings the most incredible moments for characters and for the plot itself of most games. And yeah, that's pretty much all I had to say on that.
Clint?
I was going to bounce off what Rich was talking about multiple hard, multiple failures. And I generally don't make hard moves unless I actually just tell them straight up what will happen if they fail. Because I don't want to like have to think of it right at that moment. It's part of my process to like actually make it compelling and be like, okay, if you do this, you're going to take whatever damage or this will happen. Do you want to do it? Which kind of goes against some of the rules in some games, but I'm just like, this is what this is how I want to roll it. And then they can at least like be part of that negotiation, kind of like what Blades does, where you can kind of balance position effect, but I don't really do many force games. But kind of letting them buy into it and then they roll with full knowledge of what that hard move will result in.
Yeah, there's that the admonition not to speak the name of its move of a move that used to be in a lot of early PBTA that I'm glad we don't see people talking about as much. It isn't as big a thing. Because I do think it is worth doing some meta conversation. I will say the other thing for me with the Death Spiral is I am watching people's reactions acutely. I think that's probably the most important thing is th because there are some players that are very even tempered about those kinds of things, and there are some players that I can see them getting more and more frustrated. And I think that the two and then cutaway is a good solution to that. Get like the miss being success, but here's this other big thing you're going to have to deal with down the line. Rather than I'm going to, because one of the challenges here, and again, at the base, we didn't talk about this, is a base principle for both hard moves, soft moves, for cost, for consequences, is you don't want to undercut things that they've already built. You don't want to undercut successes that they've already gained. You don't want to take those away immediately. You want to be careful about that. The problem shouldn't destroy what they've just built in that moment. I don't think it can cause threats to it. It can create problems for it, but you've got to be really careful about that. So Ian, you had a question?
And first I just wanted to respond to what Ronan was saying about the principle of failing forward. Because I do tend to, I'm running to Forged in the Dark games right now. There is a sort of assumption of player character competence that the games have, even if the players maybe don't. And I think that it's a really nice way to kind of underline, like, these people know what they're doing. Even if you don't know how to hack a computer or hotwire a car or anything, like, the person that you're playing does. My question, I think, following from what Rich was saying about the parallel moves, parallel hard, or maybe it was perpendicular, hard and soft moves, is to what extent do you feel that there needs to be a causal link between what the player character was doing or trying to do and the consequences of that role? Is it enough to just show something bad happening that's like unrelated to what they were up to? Would that sort of like make it too wishy-washy? Maybe that's like a game by game or group by group determination. I don't know. I'm curious about your thoughts.
That's a really good question because if you go or perpendicular all the time, then people will say, "What? Why even dice? Why rolls? If you're just going to do this random thing, if it starts to feel random, I do a perpendicular move once a session, maybe. Most of the time, a hard move, a soft move is directly tied to the fiction of the move that a player engaged. However, it's very clear. Think off screen, announce future badness. Those future badnesses can be your perpendicular move. So it's nested in there. I'm not cheating, but yeah, you've definitely hit the nail on the head, Ian, that there is a risk of if I'm fighting with this person and this building blows up, then okay, great. But now what is happening with the fight, or why did I engage in this move? So you do have to be careful about that.
Ronan?
Sorry, no, I was just going to say I need to drop. So good
Thank you
night.
for it was nice to have you here to chat with us.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll say too, I think the genre, like again, we're going back to the tropes and things like that. I think that also pays off. Pasiones, telenovela, melodrama. There is a, I do a lot of cutaways in that. Somebody messes something up and I cut away to, you know, their brother selling them out to another person, or the revelation of a disguised third twin or whatnot. We cut to those be and with the idea that we're playing to the audience of the television show at that point, that they're going to gasp. The players don't know what's going on, but we've created this, or the characters don't know what's going on, but we've created this tension that and more junk that we're going to be throwing in later.
Just to dovetail on that, Lowell, I think cutaways are such a great tool for a hard move. Number one, it buys me time. But yeah, I will let them come up to the move, roll the dice, biff it, cut away from them. Maybe I hint towards a hard move that I maybe had in mind, but it wasn't fully fleshed out. Jump to someone else and let them just sit on it. And just stew and worry and fret, and then come back to them. And sometimes I've even jumped past the hard move that I like pocketed in as an announcement, or I'll hit them with a left hook where they thought it was the right cross. Oh, it looks like the truck. No, it turns out that this person tackled and now you're rolling over here, and it's great. It's a great little tool, and it's also a great way to buy you some time if you don't have an idea where to go.
It breaks up one of the problems in some early PPTA games. I think people again have gotten away from this, is moves that fractal into other moves, where, well, we've done this, and because you've gotten this miss, now you have to make this other move, and you know there's a chain effect. Impulse Drive has it on, well, some of the spaceship moves where you could suddenly go, we're three moves deep on this. I still want to resolve what we're doing at the top layer. That can get to be a challenge. And cutting away, pausing it. I have a shelf that I put my hard moves on. It's literally a physical shelf that was given to me. It's here underneath the monitor, and it says hard moves on it. And I will tell people that I'm going to take that hard move and I'm going to put it on the shelf here, and it will come back in a bit. And it is often because I haven't thought of something really terrible at that moment, and I want to let that marinate. The fail forward we talked about, mentioned that a couple of times here. I'm wondering what people think about the challenge of not the fails, the hard moves and stuff, but the things that happen on the 4 to 5, on Forge in the Dark, or the 7 to 9, those places where we have those costs and consequences. Like what is the challenge of those? What are the things that you've discovered with those? I will say one of the things that I have discovered over time is that there is a basic move in Hearts of Wulin that I have come to hate for one reason, and it's the 7 to 9. Because I've got a bit of text in there that I really should have thought about what the implications were of it. So when you duel a foe that is of equal scale on a 7 to 9, you can choose to show them mercy, let them go, and those two things are separated. And showing a villain mercy as a cost is not that big a cost most of the time. Like, that's a heroic choice. But letting them get away, that's an actual like pause. That's an actual choice. And my intent, I kind of in my mind conflated those things. And I need to get that out of there. I need to say, if you want it to be a cost, it has to be that you let them get away. not just that you show them mercy, because what I found is in the heat of the moment, people will go to that easy cost. It's one of those places where, I mean, that it's too easy a choice. It's too easy a cost in that move. And it's something I need to fix with that. So, Rich, do you find that there are certain moves where the players go for X cost all the time?
X cost all the time. I want to say yes. Like, I want to yes and you, but I try to do the menu, and maybe I just internalize someone's always gonna try to look cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've talked about the hard move of you could do this or this, but this one you won't look cool.
Oh yeah.
There are certain people who, like, yeah, they will take whatever pain there is as long as they still look cool, which amuses me. And there are other people who I'll hit them with a fictional hard move and they will actually circle back and say, so do I take a condition or like, am I taking some harm here based on the game mechanics? And I'm just like, I thought that was pretty hard, but okay. Well, if you want to make it harder, okay, cool. You can have that mechanical thing too. Yeah, there you go. I meant that. Yep, just waiting for you to ask. Yes.
I haven't assigned the class any homework yet.
Yeah. 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 Sometimes those straight up, like, just narrative hard moves, a lot of the folks I play with, they're like, okay, but yeah, but like, what do I mark on my sheet? I need that. And I get that. We have mechanics that also drive the narrative. I'm not tossing aside that concern. I'm actually saying sometimes Rich gets so excited about the fiction that he forgets the underpinnings that can reinforce that fiction in future times and also reflect it in a way where you can look on the sheet or look on the character keeper and see, oh yeah, that condition, when, you know, that I got that condition because of, so I took this harm right here because of that fictional event.
No, I think that's,
I think,
yeah. Shane?
I was going to say, I think like the 7-9 result is where I'm most likely to sort of talk through mechanically what's happening with the players just to make sure we're all on the same page where, you know, I might say, okay, so 7-9, that means you succeed. So like X, Y, and Z happens. But there's also a complication or cost, which I think is going to be this. Like, does that still feel to you like you got what you wanted out of your move? So yeah, trying to be transparent in those in particular, because I think it can be a bit fiddly to, like, yeah, preserve the sense that they did hit, they are succeeding, but also, yeah, let them know like which part of this strange complex fiction that's swirling all around them is actually the complication that came from the dice in this moment.
You nailed it, Shane. Boy, I'm all about nailing things today. Sorry. I completely agree with you, Shane, that the 7-9, the most important thing to me, that's a success. The thing that they were trying to do, they get it. You can't take that away. You can take a lot of other stuff away if that's what you choose to do. But there's some victory in there, and you've got to make sure. And I like, Shane, the idea of checking in. Like, hey, you hit this move to do this thing. You got that, right? We're cool. We're cool. Okay, good. Smart.
It's one of the places where I actually, when I play Forge in the Dark, I think I have kind of the hardest, like, time with it is when we get those 7-9 moments, and I'm not sure exactly where we're supposed to be in the place in making those choices. Ian?
Yeah, I specifically have a response regarding Forge, which has been my sort of theme tonight. I guess, you know, from a bird's eye view, I think the thing that I try to take into account is like what is the larger premise of the game, you know? Not even the genre, but like the shape of what the characters are trying to do. And I'll give you two examples, which is, you know, it's funny considering that these are both like the games that I've played the most of, but they're very different in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that in in Blades and Scum and Villainy and, you know, and other kinds of things that are heist games, even when the characters are doing well, the clock is still ticking down. And so I will usually use a 4 to 5 result to tick a clock that is not desired or beneficial. It's like, yeah, you know, you're doing great, but you know, it took you a little too long to talk your way past that guard or to pick that lock or whatever. You know, there's time is starting to build up. On the and then, you know, to the corollary of that is I will usually reserve arm for a, like a full miss on a move, unless it's obvious. And the inverse of this is the other game that I have played the most of, which I have to struggle to keep from evangelizing at every opportunity, is Heart the City Beneath. That's a game where people come to play that game because they want to see their guy get made a hash of, you know. And so I feel like a mixed success, or you know, in that game it's a 6 to 7. I love to give them stress. I love to sort of, you know, give them progress towards what they want, which is to see their guy grow eyes on the inside of their head, you know? Because I think that's like the cathartic thing that people are sort of building up to, so to speak. And only on a full miss in that game will I be like, and you've lost your grappling hook, which means it's going to take you longer to get to the place that you're trying to go or something. Because the heist game is all about racing against the clock, and the Heart of the City Beneath is all about getting, if you'll pardon my saying so, fucked up.
There is that thing with Fortune of Dark that like a common default, like 4 to 5 result is reduced effect. And while, you know, it makes sense, it's logical, it makes sense, it often feels like weak sauce as a reaction. So that's one of those places where I often get stuck sometimes.
Yeah, reduced effect means, oh, great, this is going to take longer and more die rolls. Awesome. So excited. Thanks for that.
I'll mention a game that's based on Fortune of Dark that I just played that was very interesting for how it slightly modified the mechanical bits, and that is The Hunted, which is very much a game about your, I mean, it's you know, your characters versus a slasher, so it's kind of built that way with the forge mechanics, and it has an interesting thing where it splits out the 4 and the 5. And so 6 is a full success. 5 is essentially a soft move success, and the 4 is a hard move success. Like you're going to get what you want, but it is going to be painful. And it's very interesting at how that slight mechanical shift and the tone of it being a game in which you are being pursued by some faceless monster, like it really pays off there. Another interesting thing I'll mention that I think is worth us like pointing at is where games put the choice for the 7 to 9 in the player's hand versus the GM's hand on that. I think that's an interesting distinction that occurs about who is in control of that middle section.
I really dislike this as a GM or MC. I, even though when I run games, I often do like default to asking the players, like, what do you think happens? Like, what goes wrong? I do not like when the game formalizes putting that in the hands of the players.
Oh, interesting.
Possibly for control freak reasons, but I just don't care for it.
That's interesting. I would have thought you would have said the opposite way. That's really, really interesting. You know, and of course, early PBTA games, sometimes they would forget to tell you who made those choices on that, and you'd be looking through the text and going, okay, who is actually making this decision? Rich, your opinion on that?
I guess I'm contrary to Shane. I'm sorry. I love when the players have to choose because I don't know. It's a little bit of Schadenfreude. You rolled the mixed success, and now you got to sit on like which of these things am I willing to give up to get the thing that now I don't even know if I want. I just oh, I love it. It's oh, so it can slow down the game. So I do try to keep in mind, okay, what's the pace of where we're at? Where are we at in the sessions, total time allotted? If you've got a person who will hem and haw, I will sometimes, hey, you know what? Let me cut away here so you can sit on that. Let me let you think about that. That one seems rough, right? And I'm gonna jump over here. And then boom, I just switch spotlights, and then they get to take all the time in the world, and I get to key each other, like, look back, like, are you done sweating it? No, okay, all right, I'll kick back to you in a minute. But yeah, it's fun. Pronouns throw me off in game books and all books. So yeah, when it's like, I don't know who's supposed to be choosing the thing in the 7 to 9, I just want to pull my hair out. Like I've literally emailed the game designer to go, okay, I'm just a little confused. I'm sorry. I'm sure you've explained this on a podcast somewhere, but like when you say this, did you mean this or did you mean this? And I don't have the bully pulpit of +140 anymore, so they're probably gonna ignore me.
I suppose it's really important then in that circumstance, like you're describing, Rich, for, as you called it, the menu to be especially carefully curated. Because if there is an option that is like the easy way out, there is a certain type of player that's going to take that every time. And you know, maybe a slightly less common type of player who will take the opposite every time. I can't say I've run into very many of that second type of player in my own experiences.
I have on occasion, and I think one of the things that though I have learned with that is if that's what they want out of the play, if that's what they enjoy, then that's cool. Like if they want to play defensively, if they are worried about their character in that way, and they do continually do that. There was a person who used to play in the community, who I would play with, and every time I would throw something to them, they would pull back. They'd let things happen and it would go, but I'm like, look at all of this bounty of exciting choices and interesting things that could happen here. I've thrown them out. I've pushed the plate over to you, and you've been like, no, that's okay. And I have a hard time not taking that personally as a GM. Because look, I've been cooking all day. Surely you'll eat some of this. No, you can have that ding dong that you brought with you. Okay. But you do eat a bunch of crap down at the, office.
Much
And
less than this metaphor, bring a dish to the potluck, right?
exactly. And I have had to learn that to myself, to go like, hey, that's just how some people play, and that's what they enjoy. And that is cool. If that's what you get out of the game, Any other thoughts,
I have a
ideas,
thought. I have a
questions?
thought. It's
Rich.
yay, yay. So I didn't really get clocks when I first saw it in Apocalypse World. I didn't quite get it. It wasn't until I stopped hating Blaze in the Dark and said, okay, maybe it's got some cool stuff in it, that
That
I
was a
started.
very long time,
It
by the way. I just
was
want to tell
very
you
like
all, I was there for the years of Rich in the Wilderness,
dozens of
hating.
sessions. Just, I still hate the setting of Blaze in the Dark.
Right.
Hate the
But go
setting.
on.
Because if there's no sun, how did they have food? They'd all die. They'd all
Yeah.
die. I know it's atmospheric, but I don't get it. Anyway, clocks. So, Ian, I talked about dissuade your players from thinking that you thought ahead, but clocks are a great way in a PBTA game. And if you want to do it in a Forged in the Dark game, but it's a great way to just kind of like set up your hard moves and just put them on this clock. This is, I imagine this building, and here are all of the ramifications of bad things that can happen. And I'm going to preload all these up here in each of the ticks of the clock. And you could just put it off to the side, and maybe you announce future badness and you're ticking off one of the clocks. Maybe you try to get them engaged by letting them see one of the ticks of the clock happen. But it can be a really good way to give you, if I will admit, there are times coming into a game where I'm like, I need to prep more because I feel a little out of sorts with what's happening in this game so far. Or I feel very strongly, or let's be honest, several wishes have been expressed about, I want to see this building blow up. And so now I have to make it an important building, and I need to know what's going to happen. And I won't plan anything else. I try not to plan over much. And sometimes I just daydream and I have a couple of notions. But there are times where I'll have that clock and maybe I don't put it on the table, although it can be really, really fun to put it on the table. But that clock can be a really great tool if you got ants in your pants about this thing that you want to have happen. And sometimes just creating that clock and setting up those moves to know how it goes gives me enough structure to never even deal with the thing, but I have always got it in my back pocket. Maybe it even gives me enough structure to pivot off of it and just ignore all the hard moves because they did a thing that obviated ticks 7 through 12. But that's the kind of prep that I do when I prep, if need be, is I will create a clock, or I'll move pieces of the menu in, and I'll try to form them into this, like a masked villain, or the labyrinth move, a little bit of study that, my God, ChatGPT has made me such a lazy GM. But those are things. I think clocks are a really good way to help, either when you're new to MCing or you feel uncomfortable with where things are, and you just want to have some kind of firmament to stand on as you come into the game.
When I set down a 10 or a 12 step clock, it feels like the scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail where Lancelot is approaching the castle for 5 minutes, and then before you know it, it's done and he's there, and the building is blowing up. I often find, as far as as far as clocks go, I find I often don't end up fulfilling them at all, especially if it's the way that I like to use them, which is something bad will happen when you when this clock fills up. Either the players just roll too well, or like something else happens that like changes the context enough. But I do feel like it is a useful tool. You said that the one of the moves from Burning Hearts Forever is to wind up a punch. Like, to see the cruise missile coming from like so far away, right? Even if it does, even if it never actually gets there, it's still like creating tension and heat, and there's consequences to what is going to happen. A lot
So
of it.
I have to express the. Sorry. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's okay. It's just a lot of the time the missile doesn't actually get where it's going.
So
That's
I
it.
have to express the contrary view. I hate clocks. I think like I do understand like the last two things that we've talked about, like where my difference from Rich is in particular. Like I as the GM or MC or whatever, I want to have a lot of control over pacing, and I feel like the clock takes it away. Like if they know that the building's going to blow up, I would rather they're just worried that could happen at any moment. I feel like the clock gives us all too much clarity about like exactly when that might occur, like how much risk they're taking in any particular beat. Like the same with the missile. If it's just a move, like the missile's launched, it's coming. Like that is enough suspense and tension for me to like ride. I don't need to be like ticking off beats on a clock as it gets closer, so that everyone knows exactly how far away it is.
Right, so you do like clocks, but only when they're in like two step.
Two-step clocks.
I think all clocks should be two steps.
Yes.
That's right. It's coming and it's happening. That's
Yes.
it.
Now, I've gone back and forth on this, and I'm on how clocks get used and how I'm still not sure on that. So I can see where that's coming from. Well, that missile over there is coming from anyway. I will say this on the player side too, something we don't talk about often is I do think that with the costs and the hard moves and things like that, one of the things and we as players need to learn and be willing about is like if a hard move kind of violates your sense of autonomy or is putting some things out there that don't fit with where your character is at, being willing to say, you know, can we negotiate? Can I add something to that? Can I modify that? Would it be okay if I did that? Because I think that's a tough thing for players to do, especially more trad players who have been in that absolutist, here's what the GM has said has happened way to learn to do that. And you know, that's why very often when I do any hard moves, the next thing out of my mouth is, does that seem okay? You know, it is the check-in for that. And I think players kind of have to learn to do that and have the willingness to do it. Any other questions, any other thoughts, any other bits before we wrap here?
I was just going to tack onto what you just said.
Yeah.
Sometimes you give them a hard move. I'll even ask them what they think the hard move should be. And then if it's not hard enough, then we can, the other players can help. Oh, excuse me, coughing dog. The other players can help add to it because then they can't really be upset about anything bad because they're the ones that made it up. So.
Yeah, I think that sharing collaborative work is just like that just that basis of asking people and let's talk about what it is and work it out together. You know, if there's a sea change in GMing for me over the last 2 decades, it is that like as a major principle, because that's not what I did. If we go pre-2000, I don't even want to think about how I ran back
No,
then.
the pre-2000, who even cares? That's a whole century away now.
Century away. In the past century when I was running.
It's a different millennium.
Yeah, thank
In the
you.
late 1900s.
I want to thank everybody for coming on and chatting and talking about this. One of the things that I don't, we may do another one of these somewhere down the road, maybe April or May. One of the things is that Ondish has set up, if we've got a container now for people doing kind of meetup to talk about game design or game work or things like that. And I know he's going to be, we're putting on some events for people just to kind of get together to talk about what they're doing. We can also do those things for maybe like kind of general GM shop talk. Sessions and things like that. That's the thing we're adding to the calendar to try and get more support for people who want to ask questions, who want to talk about these things, you know, or even talk about a particular game. We'll see what we come up with on that. And anybody is welcome to put events in that container on the calendar. So thank you all very much. I am going to stop the recording.